Last week, we had open lines and talked about the discoveries of the William Henry venture to Egypt. And this week, we are privileged to have the inventor of the Life Stream Generator and the owner of Zero Point Research, John Riley, with us. He is formerly with Lockheed Skunk Works and ran a very successful special effects group in Hollywood. His quick thinking and amazing engineering has been applied to the field of new energy for the past few years, and has produced one of the most amazing energy experiences I have ever seen. Please welcome with me John Riley. How are you, John?
I'm very good, Brooks. Thanks. It's an incredible pleasure to be here tonight.
Well, I know you're coming to us from Santa Monica, California.
Yes.
And I know the town is nice and quiet, at least the streets are, because everyone is in watching the Super Bowl. And there may be a lot of listeners out there doing that right now, too, going, oh, gosh, we don't want to listen to X Squared Radio. We want to see what Tom Brady's going to do with the pigskin. Well, I have a feeling at halftime the main entertainment will be commercials. I like the commercials myself. That's the main reason I watch the Super Bowl. But we're glad you're on the air with us, and this will be the talk of the water coolers on Monday morning when the archives go up. John, we have spoken before on and off the air a lot, and we've worked together, and I have never asked you about your path to new energy. When you were in engineering for someone else, how did you become aware of the design for the forms of energy you now use in your technology?
Well, that is a very good structured question that could take me. I can either do this in the simplest approach, or I can go back about 25 years. But one of the things that I had the privilege to when I was back in the Skunk Works is that I had a very unusual device that I had privilege to, and it was actually a generator, not unlike what we currently use, but the special that this particular generator had, it had an adjustable frequency control as well as a voltage control. So I was able to adjust the frequency or the hertz of the actual alternating current energy that was generated from anywhere from 20 hertz all the way up to 800 hertz or 800 cycles. So it was really interesting when I used to do some side experiments to really utilize those harmonics or the frequencies that are actually sent down the electrical lines into certain devices that worked. So that really got me started. And then, you know, of course, once I moved out of the Lockheed experience, moved into special effects, we were working with, you know, many majors, A film companies from Spielberg, Cameron, and Bob Zemeckis, you know, working, literally pushing the future on all these technologies. And so I was always on the edge of bringing in, like, the first wave of something new. If I saw something in development, I would want to get a prototype and actually start working with it. That got us our reputation in the industry for being a can-do company. So once I took that and we started really getting to some of the fringe, type of films, it really started to really make me think, is this stuff, you know, really in existence? You know, I mean, can we actually achieve it? Because some of the designers really came in, you know, on the visual or on the production design when they were illustrating sets and technological pieces. I was wondering where they were grasping, you know, the layouts and how they were putting these things, you know, together. And I always asked them, they said, well, it just kind of comes to me. And I said, okay, well, but you have all the principles here, you know, and so that was actually a really good eye-opener for me. And then I did a major transition from the industry where actually I took a sabbatical, closed my company, and merged into the production aspect of filmmaking, where actually I did a couple films and then moved into the post-production aspect of the films and then spun another company. And then from that is where I would have to say is once I sat stagnant for about 2 years, not really working with my hands or working with my mind in the technological aspects, I started to go a little, I guess, crazy inside myself to get back out. And all of a sudden,
yeah.
You know, and, you know, we talked about this before where I had the DVD company and one of my clients, it was a new client, they were going to try me out, and they handed me William Henry's Cloak of the Illuminati to put on DVD. And so I took that under my own wing, and, you know, while I was authoring this, I'm looking at these ancient symbols that all of a sudden is being brought forth once again, and it just started literally sparking things in my mind again. And I couldn't really sit still anymore. I had this quest, you know, to work on technology again. So I was really driven from these codes or symbols that I would like to say that William, you know, was. I always hold him, you know, partially responsible for my activation. And so we always get a laugh out of that, you know, because I point my finger at him. And so it's always funny. But then taking that knowledge and, you know, starting to do exploration and looking at alternative energy and really being focused on it, then really taking the step into alternative science, which was really the awakening for me when I ran across a lot of people that were working with cellular resonance, you know, understanding different principles and the human connection to energy, and also our, you know, in-depth understanding to energy that's emitted from the planet itself. So that really, you know, took me back over 100 years to Nikola Tesla. And of course, you know, once I explored the aspects, I just kept going deeper and found his radiant energy research that he started in 1899 to approximately 1923. And that was the clincher for me. That's why I started to come into a higher understanding of what Nikola Tesla was trying to bring forward on the planet. And it was really a major paradigm shift for me in regards to seeing, completely different in my way of thinking and the technical training I was taught. And, Nikola himself really went outside the box to create what we call radiant energy. It actually went against normal methods of producing electricity. And that's the reason why he had some amazing results. He was able to, you know, wirelessly transmit electricity, you know, broadly, you know, and he was able to focus it. And so he did some pretty major experiments, which was really an eye-opener. But I stumbled onto some of his earlier research where he had a connection where he was able to create an etheric energy that literally collected just about on anything. And anything metal would hold this energy, and if it was like a vase or a jar, it would literally be like a capacitor or a bell jar, and it would literally discharge an enormous amount of energy if you got anywhere near it. So this was really fascinating research for me, and I said, well, I really want to take these principles further. And then once I crossed the Nikola Tesla technology with a structure out in Landers, California called the Integratron, that was literally the clinching point for me. George Van Tassel was working on this structure for approximately 28 years, if I recall, and he actually called it a cellular rejuvenator and also a time machine. So I found this really interesting that he was calling it a cellular rejuvenator and time machine, and I was really trying to understand what he meant by the time machine aspect. But the cellular rejuvenation, once he claimed that he wasn't going to use any man-made technology, it was all going to be Earth energies that were going to generate this effect inside the Integratron, really got me thinking. And I looked at, you know, I went out there, and I brought a handful of gentlemen with me, engineers and, anywhere from a lawyer to real estate, you know, to really look at the principles and the property out there. And we did this incredible walkthrough. And once we came through after about 6 hours later, we were all on the same page of its theory of operation. But he had what was called a Wimhurst or a Dirod array that was actually a static generator, and had this really unique structure of these dirods that were on an air platform. And all he would use was a compressor and send air into this dirod array, and it would literally lift and turn on a bed of air. And then through the movement of that, it would create a static discharge. And that's what we would call the primary. That would be the kickstart of the energy producing for the Integratron. And then he went through a level of the Tesla coil technology, which would increase the voltage of the static electricity exponentially. So a lot of people called it a static generator, and a lot of the people that have walked through, the scientists and physicists, all say, yeah, it's just a static generator. But I said, well, you guys didn't really look further of what he was doing, because he's got these earth rods that are also part of the mix too. He says, yeah, well, we don't know what he was doing there. I go, well, why don't we focus on that? I said, he was actually getting it to the point where he actually was able to produce or raise an etherical energy, very similar to what would be considered radiant energy. We have to give it a name, you know, because, again, like one of the things that I was always looking at is what is the name of electricity? I mean, if it was produced before the last 110 years on this planet, you know, was there actually a given name for it? So I didn't have that information at the time of this research, but I do now. This is when we start, you know, the further back I keep going, I went back 100 years to create, you know, to bring this technology forward. But then we started going back 1,000 years. We started going back 5,000 years. We started realizing that there was energy being produced, you know, for centuries.
Well, that's really interesting. You and I both know William Henry. In fact, that's how we got to know you. He said, you've got to meet this guy named John Riley. And so that was part of the iterations for me and my career as well. But the interesting thing is that William and those people that know William Henry know he is a magnificent Egyptian mythologist. But he's not want to get too caught up in the metaphysical part of it. He's more of a factual reporter, more of an observer, and he notices patterns and things that other people don't notice, and he reports them. Now, the interesting thing is that he discovers these structures that evidently were built anciently, way, way back in the time of Seti in the 16th Egyptian dynasty, and he copied them down and said, this is really strange. What in the world is this structure? And you saw it in one of the videos that you were, duplicating and sending out for him. And this icon sort of sparked your engineering genes again, and it activated, you know. It's kind of ironic because, you know, not many people would think that William Henry could metaphysically activate anyone because he's so slow to get activated. But it's really interesting how that fell together. When you say 5,000 years ago, you literally mean it. And then, you know, later discoveries in Tibet where their researchers, their engineers, their gross national product was expended for an amazing structure that looks alarmingly like a Tesla coil, except it's 1,300 years before Tesla invented his. Now, the interesting thing about Tesla and the interesting thing about you is that the designs for what you have and the designs for what Tesla had don't exist anywhere. They sort of come to you like, it's very difficult to explain. Why don't you explain how these icons turned you on and clicked lights on inside of you that started you designing?
Well, that takes us a little further down the rabbit hole, you know, in regards to the way that my research does come and how we apply. But when we all, you know, understand, you know, the level of our conscious thinking, this is something that really is, you know, if we really go and really focus on it, we realize how the mind is constantly processing and bringing in information. And all of a sudden, we can just have a thought. And this thought will create a complete structure, and it's there almost in a nanosecond within our minds. And so we're like, you know, and sometimes I would sit there, you know, in my industry times and producing, and always constantly coming up with like clever, you know, short stories to produce, you know, and to create them. And all of a sudden, I'd be sitting there, and this entire story would just be there, you know, complete front, middle, and back. And I'm like, well, that would make a great story. But it, you know, it wasn't anything linear. It was just immediate. So I wanted to use that, you know, when we talk about the creative process. And of course, then we ask, well, how in the heck did that just drop in my head? You know, so when I got to that point of thinking, and then when we all realize that our minds do work on that process, takes us into the level of what we consider consciousness, and then moving into the super consciousness. Now, we can go into many levels of research and understanding, everything from remote viewing to ESP, you know, all different levels of research, knowing that there are frequencies that the mind operate on that are broadcasting. you know, constantly.
Well, where I think I wanted to go with this is a lot of people, let's just talk about the ancient Tibetans who were meditating and trying to concentrate on how to open and manipulate stargates. The Egyptians, obviously Seti, really concerned with how to move maybe his physical being or his spiritual being through the underworld and back into maybe toggle between worlds, as William puts it. And then you, who get this whole design in your head from raw cloth, develop the Lifestream technology. What I'm saying is that this story, this design, this technology, the form of energy came to all three generations, and each of them interpreted that different and used their hands and their local technology or the technology at hand, or maybe develop new technology to bring that to reality. But a lot of people get that idea. It's just not many people, in fact, darn few people, actually make it happen. So what I really want to know is, what is that drive that wakes you up in the middle of the night with this idea? Do you just blow it off and say, oh, gee, yeah, but I got to make a living? Or do you say, now I see that. I see how it works, and I see what it can be used for.
Yes. No, you're actually correct in the way that you just explained it. I was about 30 seconds away from getting to exactly what we're going to talk about now. But of course, one of the things that I, you know, once I became and what's called an inventor, and I realized that I created a device that has an amazing effect and connection to our higher level understanding and us tapping into a new level of technology, I had to really look at that. I had to really think about it. I had to look at it from every single aspect of where my life was, and then also what this can do if it moves, you know, into the world. And so, you know, that is something that an inventor has to really contemplate all the time, you know, because you take your prototype and you'll move it out there and you'll look for the biggest check, you know, and try to get it into production. There are many ways where you can look at it and say, how can I get this across the world where it's going to do its best, you know, for the people and for the planet.
Right.
So these are and I always believed in playing scenarios out, always in my mind. I would play something out 75 to 150 times before I would act on it, just so I played out all the scenarios of possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, something in regards to, I like to coin a, you know, the phrase, with great power comes great responsibility. And when you're given that, we have to be very responsible for what we do to it. You know, because there's always a positive effect to any technology that's out there, and there's always a negative effect to any technology that's out there. And that applies on anything that's out today. You know, so when we really understand the levels of responsibility, we sit down in a conscious think tank and we say, how do we move this forward, and, you know, for the betterment, you know, of mankind, for the betterment of the planet. You know, so this is something I contemplate in my work every single day.
Right, but you have what is rare, and that is you have the experience, you have the work experience. I'm kind of reminded of, I don't want to really stretch way out there, but the Steven Spielberg movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when Richard Dreyfuss is just being driven nuts with this image, this icon that's in his mind, and he draws and he paints, and then he starts using mashed potatoes, and then he uses the mud and bushes from his own yard, and he finally gets the connection, what it is. And it toward the end of the movie, only a handful of people actually made it to Colorado. They followed their drive, and they overcame all obstacles to get to that point. Only a handful, but only one made it to the top.
Exactly.
So
absolutely.
You know,
we forget that sometimes when we look deep into that script, that hundreds were activated, and only two made it. You know, and then he was the last one, you know, Devil's Tower, Wyoming. And again, when we look at the, you know, the symbolism, when everyone saw that, however they got it in the newspaper, in the news, you know, or driving by, they got activated. You know, so now, you know, Steven Spielberg plays a very intricate role, you know, into, if you really look at a lot of the films that he does, he's an activator. You know, I mean, he literally brings us, you know, pushes us out of our boxes to think beyond what we have been brought up into and what the structure is. So all of a sudden, that one person, we see this one man's triumph and his obsession or drive to, you know, to get there, and then we see the final result, the reason why. You know, so it really makes us all think, because I grew up, you know, of course, you know, with the, you know, the Spielberg films at hand constantly in my mind. I can't really think of much of a time where I wasn't influenced by these films. So it really makes it very interesting. And, of course, it was an absolute honor to be working on these films with him. So that was a real interesting crossover for me in my life.
Sure, sure, absolutely. And so you saw, you know, the work that was behind the cellulose and all the things that ended up on the cutting room floor that were great ideas, but somehow this director had a plan of what he wanted to come off the screen to people in that chair. Sure, he wanted to make it entertaining, of course, and he had John Williams for music. I mean, how can you go wrong there? But the storyline, the idea that some communication between an off-world race or maybe not an off-world race, maybe another race that used to live here, it's hard to tell, and us resulted in, well, it had results. People actually acted on it. And some people, in fact, most people, were asleep. They didn't get it. They didn't listen. It didn't resonate with them. And this is really the core of invention. I did a short biography on four mathematicians, and as I was doing research on them, I really didn't expect to find this, not with mathematicians anyway, maybe with a musician, but not with a mathematician. They all talked about dreams that they had, daydreams that they had, where new math, I'm not talking about derivations, I'm talking about new formulas, new mathematical relationships, that were just dropped into their brain. And because they had the previous training, or at least a propensity to think mathematically, they got it. They understood it. And they took mathematics to a new level. And that happens every single day in this world. Some people act on it, some people don't, and some people never get it.
That's very true. Well, when Nikola Tesla talked, you know, himself, I mean, he was completely developed, all his technologies were complete within his mind, and all he had to do from that point was just three-dimensionalize it, build it. You know, but he, and I, you know, before I really did so much research on Nikola Tesla and others like him, I did the same thing in the motion picture industry where I had to develop technological circuits, and I would literally, you know, like go home with these thoughts in my head, and I'd put the circuits together. And, you know, just before I went to sleep, I said, okay, that's how I'll build it. And the next morning, I'd wake up, I'd go into the office, and I'd start building it. Sometimes some of my employees or the clients would come over and see this massive circuit board, you know, with just all these components, and they're like, they look at it, and they go, where's the schematic?
Yeah,
and it goes in my head. And they're like, you're kidding. You know, they're just like, they can't believe that I'm pulling this out of my head. They go, "You, what are you using as a reference?" I said, it's all in my head. I'm just bringing it out. I built this thing in my head, now I'm bringing it out. And they're like, they couldn't believe it, you know, and then we'd put it in and the thing would work perfectly, you know.
Oh, that's
so
amazing.
Yeah, you know, it is a wonderful, once we realize that, you know, because I always thought almost everyone had that gift until I really stepped into the industry because the, working in the Skunk Works, you know, you're given something and it's just they give you the result or they tell you what they want. Now, when I went into the industry, we were... The one movie I can really remember was Back to the Future 2 when Bob Zemeckis wanted 30-year-in-the-future technology. I mean, tangible stuff. This is before visual effects could do it, you know, CG, you know, on the high level. So when we were looking at that, and he was looking all over, and he had this best special effects people, you know, and they were giving the illustrations, and they were going, well, this is the best we can do. And he goes, that's not good enough. I needed to do this. And so he kept putting it out there, and they stumbled upon me in my little hole in the wall back then in the late 80s, and they just said, oh, by the way, can you do this? And I'm like looking at it, and I'm like, yeah, I think that's possible. They go, you sure? Because the best effects guys say it's not. And I go, well, give me a couple days to really, you know, work through it. So by the time they called me, I said, yeah, it can be done. And they kept saying, are you sure? And I go, yes. They go, well, can you do it in 8 weeks? I'm like, ooh, yeah, okay. And they go, well, is it going to be expensive? I went, yes. You know, and they said, well, if you can do it, we'll pay for it. And we brought it forward. You know, I mean, we were able to pull it off, and Bob Zemeckis was just ecstatic, came up and just congratulated us, and I didn't realize Steven Spielberg was 7 feet away when he did that, and I got the nod from Steven Spielberg. So that was, it never got any better than that, you know, in the industry.
Yeah.
That was it.
Really?
You know, so yeah, there was nothing that ever was a better moment, you know, so, but I always have that one, which is great, so. But it was just, it showed us that, and if we look at it, if we really look at the way the human mind thinks, all we have to do is see it. All we have to do is create it, and then we can manifest it. And this is really amazing because it's like, I mean, if you get a person, if you sit a bunch of people in the room and you hand this design to someone, they go, can you build it? They go, well, I don't know how to do that. What do? We go to the next guy. And we go to the next guy until eventually we find someone who says, yeah, I think we could pull that off. You know, but then there's a creation process that happens, and it's just amazing. You know, all we have to do is get that visualization in our mind and believe we can build it, and it's there. You know, so this is really, you know, been an interesting process for me, is that, especially in the industry, we were known as a can-do company. We never said no to anything. You know, I mean, we never turned down a job, you know, regardless.
When it gets down to it, who wants to do something that's been done before?
Well, sure, absolutely. You know, I mean, there's always, especially in the industry, it's, you know, on the visual effects, everybody wants the next level. Every film comes out, everyone's in expecting of that. So you always have to bring it to the next level. Yeah. So,
well,
I can
tell you that there are a lot of filmmakers that are sorry that John Reilly and his group are not doing special effects in the movies anymore.
Well, thank you. I do appreciate that. But I did segue at the perfect time because, you know, everything went from practical, you know, to the CGI aspect. So I knew either we're going to have to, you know, change all the machining equipment to, you know, high-speed computers, you know, and stay with that or venture out. So I think I really feel, actually, I know that I made the right decision and to move into alternative energy and science.
Sure. Sure.
I mean, it's so gratifying. Every day I'm just so grateful of what I'm doing.
I happened to cruise into the Star Trek marathon today, and I'm talking about the newest one that's out. And I was on it for 4 or 5 minutes or something like that, and some reptilian alien was taking over the ship, two or three of them. And they had the corniest Walmart ray guns I've ever seen. And I thought, oh, man. No, I just know John Reilly and his group could have given these guys some really cool ray guns to come on the bridge of the Enterprise with. I mean, these things look like the old little, you remember the little disc guns? They used to fire little discs before choking hazards robbed us of all the great toys.
Well, some of the designers have fun. They actually literally go out and they get that stuff as a joke and then daub it up, you know, put really unique paints on them. And we go on the sets and we see these things and we all get a laugh out of it.
Yeah,
you know, because they, you know, because they're just like, you know, a new alien race. They're not, you know, they're not going to be there forever. So they just grab whatever they can to do it. But are you talking about Star Trek Enterprise?
Yeah, Star Trek Enterprise.
Yeah, we did work on that show. We did the spacesuits, if you remember those.
Jump
around. Yeah, we really loved working on those.
Cool.
Yeah,
I just expected if he pulled the trigger, I really didn't want him to because it looked like a marshmallow was going to come out the end of his gun. It's just that corny looking. It kind of retroed me back to Flash Gordon when they used to pull a revolver on Mars and shoot at the aliens. So, you know, we're nearing the bottom of the first hour. Actually, we have about 16, 17 minutes in the first hour, and I want to, you know, make sure that everyone knows certainly that they can call in. I think the fate of the Super Bowl is about sewn up by now, so... in anywhere in the U.S. and Canada, you can call us at 888-228-4494. Those phone lines are open. People are sitting in the studio right now. In Canada, 877-489-6350. And anywhere else on Earth, on planet, off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us, 530-776-5154 or 5185 or 530-776-9916, or if you're using Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio, or PalTalk, you can reach us at BBS Radio _com. Don't forget, we will be starting up in our second hour the Instant Messenger, so you can reach us at AOL Instant Messenger if you want to. Now, as we make the transition from, you know, engineering is engineering to some respect. I mean, we're always doing things that have never been done before. I myself am up here in Washington State working on the state's first biodiesel plant. Now, there are several wannabes up here, and many have tried and not made it, and there are some that are refining in some form or another. But this plant is the first of its kind, and it's going to be amazing to watch it run. And, you know, for 30 years or so, I engineered for the manufacturing industry for automotive, but I got tired of that. Making cars just didn't turn me on anymore. At what point did John Reilly say, you know, making special effects of the movies or building rockets or doing a movie production, although that is, you know, the work of Hollywood, as it were, in the area that you live, at what point did you say, you know, this icon is really turning me on to something that's in my mind, and I've got the ability and I've got the tools, I feel called to do something in energy? How did you know what to do in energy? How did you know what direction to go?
Well, the first wave, when I really look back at it, it wasn't really something that I was 100% directed to do, because we were always creating new fringe technology. And one of the things that I could have literally patented, you know, during my time in the industry, about 35, you know, cutting edge technologies that we had, you know, of course, or the studio money and, you know, thousands upon thousands of dollars, you know, invested on, you know, brand new prototype level technologies. And
right,
after they were filmed, they'd get tossed in the trash. I mean, it was completely wasted. And of course, if I, you know, had a, you know, much bigger, you know, level, you know, in our company, I would have literally had a patenting division after we were done with these technologies and moved them forward. You know, but we didn't, you know, because we always had to move on to the next film, you know, or the next TV show. So
right,
it was, we had these big bins of all these prototype technologies or things that were applied. So taking, you know, taking that work and then moving out of the industry and then sitting for a couple of years and then coming up with new concepts, you know, in post-production or DVD, that's, again, and then that level of reactivation or moving back into technology, that's when I started noticing that there was like this, the human earth connection and this level of energy that was kind of considered a mystery. And of course, we're very familiar with the last 100 or so odd years, the planet has been utilizing what we call alternating current or direct current. So
right, right.
When we go back 100 years, when they called it the current wars, when there was a battle over AC versus DC, and this is really interesting, you know, to see this, because they were trying to wire the world, and DC was a poor traveler of electricity. Alternating current would go for hundreds of miles without any loss. You know, so in the long run, it won out. But then 23 years later, this was really interesting that a lot of people don't know this, is Nikola Tesla, the creator of alternating current, literally came forward, you know, to industry, and he said, well, we really should change this. And everyone's like saying, why? He says, well, because it's, you know, after further research, it's not really harmonious to us as humans or as the planet. And they're like, okay, I think it's time for you to retire. You know, they didn't want to hear that because they already had the structure implemented. You know, I mean, if anybody all of a sudden, you know, came up with the technology today, you know, and said, oh, here, this will replace all the power lines, you know, there's an infrastructure, and it's not going to be, you know, it's going to fall on deaf ears, if you know what I mean. And it's too drastic of a shift of the paradigm because we have so much that's involved, and a lot of people don't realize, well, we've got 100 years invested into wiring the world, you know, so this
well,
is like...
Well, yeah, we have 100 years invested in wiring a grid, as it were. And
a grid,
when you
yeah.
Look at, when you look at Earth from space, it's lit up, to be sure, but it's lit up along the pathway of the wires that the industry has laid.
Yeah.
And where there are no wires, there's no lights. And where there are no lights, there are no people. So in a sense, the power distribution industry has determined where people can live.
Yes. Yeah, there was, of course, the overall vision at that particular time. It was very selective. Now, you know, we're seeing the small shift in the paradigm, and one of the things that a lot of people, you know, want, I hear this all the time, is a lot of people say, we got to do something. We got to break off the grid. We got to make changes. And they go, well, those changes are happening. And they go, well, I don't see them. I go, right, you don't see them. But they are happening. I said, there is something that's been amazingly happening, you know, for the last 10 years on this planet where independents are rising and coming up with some very brilliant, unique off-the-grid technologies. Now, I'll use one example is electric cars. We saw the automotive companies come up with electric cars, and then they just vanished. And, you know, that happened, you know, two times in our era of automobiles. You know, when cars were first created, there were so many electric cars, and there were electric delivery trucks. You know, and it was amazing. The more research you do, I have books that have these incredible vehicles that were made that ran on electricity, and they had inductor stations. They just had to drive up, and through induction, they would charge. You don't even have to plug them in. You know, and then they take off, and they go another 30 miles, and come back and charge up again, or whatever the distance was. So
Was it really conspiracy, though, that took the electric cars off the road, or was it the lack of battery technology, or was it just lack of public support?
Well, it was a combination of many things. The conspiracy aspect, you know, I don't see it from that point, because when we would talk about fossil fuels being in abundance, you know, and it was the most, you know, cost-effective way to go. I mean, when, you know, Rudolf Diesel himself created the diesel engine, you know, he didn't have diesel fuel at the time. He ran the first engine on peanut oil. You know, but then after a while, diesel fuel came forward. It was cheap, it was effective, and it was in abundance. So it replaced the making of these inefficient, you know, battery technologies. And, you know, and we were able to get, you know, I mean, when you have an electric vehicle that goes 30 to 50 miles on a charge, and then you have a gasoline-powered vehicle that'll go 250 miles, on a tank, well, which one's going to win out? You know, so it you know, it's just more of a convenience. And we are, you know, when we do our shopping, you know, we drive, you know, we look around and we look at the comparisons, and we go, well, this one gets a lot more on a tank of gas, and it gets a lot more, you know, per gallon. So we really start to focus more on those these days more than ever. You know, so that's, again, that's, right now, you know, the fossil fuels really still holds that, you know, as being the most convenient, because it's in abundance, it's being processed all over the world. But now, sure, we're looking at new technologies, because I do my own research. I go to the Eco Expos or the Alternative Car Expos, and just last year when I went, there was like about a dozen small electric vehicles being offered to the public, and this year there's over three times the amount of new electric vehicles that are coming out. And then next year, you know, we're looking at about 150 to 200 different choices of electric type vehicles that are going to be available to us, that are being made by independents, you know, that are spreading, you know, all over the place. And, you know, a lot of people, especially like us, you know, here, we're very green thinking here in Santa Monica. We only need little commuter vehicles, you know, vehicles that will get us to and fro work. You know, we go, you know, 10, 15, 30 miles back and forth. So I mean, if you can have an electric vehicle that does that, you know, then you know, I mean, it just makes sense. You know, I mean, if you're towing a lot of stuff,
you don't really have you know, sub-zero weather, so you don't have to run a heater a lot of the year, and most people you know, don't drive long distances in the dark, so you don't have to run headlights for 6 or 7 hours at a time. So there's a lot of advantage to these electric vehicles. So there is a market out there now that oil is at $100 a barrel. We look at biodiesel, for instance. Rack diesel is about $3.35 a gallon now, and you know, biodiesel is about $3.35 a gallon. So it makes sense. Plus, the biodiesel makes the diesel engines last about three times longer, and you get about 2.5 times the energy back than it takes to produce the darn stuff. So it's good all the way around, and it will free up refinery space so that the refineries could then switch their concentration to much more profitable liquids like toluene and acetone and on and on and on, all the fibers that make our clothing and polymers that make our tires and plastics and drugs and fertilizers and all kinds of stuff that's made from petroleum products. We can't
right.
build any more refineries. There's plenty of oil out there, but there's just not enough refineries to process it all by demand. And so, you know, they drive the cost up, and that's become a financial burden for a lot of people. So that's the driver for new energy. But, John, you didn't choose to go into the electric car business or the electric airplane business. You mentioned this human-Earth connection. And in our next hour, I really want to get into that and find out how this drove the core design of your technology. But for now, let's get your ideas on what do you think in the next 5 minutes. What do you think the future of this new energy is? Do you think that it's long-lived? Do you think that the economics are there and that people will drive it into the general consumer's garage?
Oh, yes. I mean, you can see this on so many aspects. I mean, when we're talking about that we live in the information age, and now that we have knowledge that is literally dropped at our fingertips, and anything... you know, that we're querying within our minds, any idea or something that we're interested in, we have the power of the Internet to bring it to us within minutes. Now, one of the things utilizing that is that there have been a lot of amazing, you know, transitions that have happened in the human species as well, seeing, you know, those structures that are in place and realizing that there's so many other options. And now, as independents, we can literally step out of those structure boxes and do something about it. So we see some amazing people coming forth with some amazing public technologies, everything from electric vehicles to biodiesel, you know, algae production. It's just, you know, it's amazing to see that. I mean, and now we're seeing, you know, of course, you know, using the agricultural aspects that we can actually grow our own fuel. And that's actually almost going back to the roots of what Diesel, you know, originally did. He used peanuts, you know, to run his engines at first. And now we're almost creating a full circle aspect, and we have that ability, you know, in the independent structure to do this. And that's
yeah.
the reason why you're working with biodiesel, and you're seeing an incredible, you know, company that really came up with a unique product. Aspect of producing and, you know, self-containing, you know, the biodiesel production itself by, you know, either, you know, creating its own feedstock and then creating it like a zero waste process in the aspect. You know, so it's just amazing to see these things popping up and literally staying, you know, in a structure, being seen by people and actually taking it serious. This is where the change is. It's not, they're not going to disappear. They're going to remain. This is where it gets exciting.
Yeah, it really does. It gets exciting. I knew that if the Internet would stay together for about 10 years, and about, oh, I don't know, 1996, 1997, it started being available to every household as cable modems became more and more popular and people began to get what we call high-speed Internet. As opposed to old dial-up. Oh, I don't even want to talk about dial-up. I get hives thinking about it. But the flash of the most incredible information library in the history of the world at the fingertips of everyone. Every 10-year-old with an imagination has access to the most advanced physics in the world. And it was only a matter of time before smart people and information came together. And within 10 years, we have seen a total transformation of our planet. And we are on the threshold of an amazing era of invention and supply and demand and being in touch with what the consumer wants rather than what industry puts on the back dock and tries to sell to us.
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen this and... you know, one of the stories I love to tell, and it's really interesting how so many people don't even realize it. And I say, do you recall a couple years ago there was a man, I think his name is Dick Rutan, who actually built his own spacecraft and launched it and went up into space, came back down, refueled it a few days later, and went back up again. And
yeah,
it was called the X Prize. Yeah, it was called the X Prize. And it was a quest for people to break their bounds and to get into space independently. And you know what? He was able to do it. But he wasn't just able to do it with his own money. He was allowed to do it. You know, he was given the airtime to do this, to go into space. So when we look at it from that aspect, that we are not really being governed, we are actually being allowed to break these bounds that we weren't able to do even 10 years ago, if we think about it. Now we're doing it. We're going out into space. And now the X Prize, they have a contest to get to Mars. You know, but one of the things, you know, I mean, when we looked at Rutan's project, I went on the website numerous times, and there was probably about 45 or so different companies with some amazing devices to get into space. Some of them were a little far-fetched, but some of them were brilliant. You know, but Rutan was able to get up there. He did it, you know, and he was able to do it very cost-effectively as well. So it's on. I mean, when we look at it from literally breaking our bounds, that's what I'm saying. Get ready. We've been asking for electric vehicles and alternative fuels. It's coming. You know, there's a mass consciousness happening to bring this stuff forward. So it's just, like I said, it just gets exciting if we really look. You know, we can talk. We can get kind of caught up in the complaining. But then when we really look and say, wow, I can have biodiesel at my doorstep in 3 days. I can buy an old Mercedes. And with a simple conversion, run it on vegetable oil, run it on biodiesel, you know, and it's there. We just have to, like, really, you know, really go, you know, take a broader look.
It's gone beyond that. I mean, Fiat, which owns a heavy equipment company in this country called New Holland, they made an announcement about 3 months ago that all their vehicles made from 2008 forward will be B100 compliant. In other words, they will run on 100% biodiesel. And all major car companies have now announced plans to release a diesel-powered vehicle. We thought diesel was just dead, that the new fuel management systems for gasoline were going to make diesel obsolete for passenger cars. But that is not the case at all. Diesel in Europe easily gets 40 to 50 miles per gallon, with a lot more horsepower than we see out of our gasoline engines here, with very little or no pollution. So there are a lot of advantages to it, and don't be surprised if the spark plug companies don't start offering a little resistance to that. Well, we're going to take a quick break, about 3.5 minutes, and we'll be back with more with John Riley, owner of Zero Point Research in Santa Monica, California. We'll be back after these messages. Don't go away.